Good evening, everybody. So let's start with our motivation. And really thinking about what the purpose of our life is. Is it just to be happy and have a good time right here and now? Well, most people like that, and we too also enjoy it. All the pleasure that we have now is over in the very next moment, and it becomes like last night's dreams or like memories from long ago. So chasing after just the happiness of this life doesn't leave us really with anything at the end of the day, because the happiness is over in the next moment. But the actions we did, the karma we created to get that happiness, that follows along with us, like a shadow follows the body, and it influences what we become, what we experience in the future. So if we want to make our lives meaningful in the long term, then we have to think beyond the happiness of this life to creating the cause for happiness in future lives. But even that isn't sufficient, because that happiness too is quite momentary. And so to create the causes to be free from the cycle of existence altogether is much more meaningful. But that too is comparatively limited when we think of the good we can do for the world by attaining full awakening. And so while the state of Buddhahood requires so many causes and conditions to attain, it's also something so valuable, not only for ourselves, but for all other living beings. And it brings lasting happiness that doesn't disintegrate. So let's have that aspiration for a full awakening, so that we can benefit others most effectively. And see listening to the teachings this evening as part of creating the causes for that state of Buddhahood. So, we've been discussing Aryadeva's 400 stanzas, and we're in the middle of chapter 6, which is abandoning afflictions, because we need to abandon afflictions not only because they cause us misery, but they impede our attaining Buddhahood. So they impede our working to our fullest capacity for the benefit of all living beings. So in particular, this chapter is talking about how to counteract confusion or ignorance, attachment or desire, and anger or hostility. Okay, the three poisons. So we were in the middle last week of talking about confusion or ignorance and how it functions and how to abandon it. Okay, so we'll start today with verse 136, which is about recognizing the antidote that eliminates confusion. Okay, so Joe Blow, our friend who always pops up and asks questions, says, "What are the means to get rid of confusion, which is the root of futility?" It's interesting. This is a good question from Job Lowe. Sometimes his questions are pretty ridiculous. This is a good one. Okay. And confusion, which is the root of futility. Why does he say the root of futility? Yeah. Because when we have the ignorance that grasps at inherent existence, that's the root of our rebirth in taking rebirth, repeated existence, in cyclic existence, and that whole endeavor of taking rebirth again and again and again, getting old, sick, and dying again and again and again, that all is an exercise in futility. So it's interesting because as human beings, we think our lives are so meaningful, everything we do is so important, and all these people running around doing big business deals and big political deals and becoming famous as sports stars or athletes or movie stars or whatever your thing is, and publishing books and putting out records and being famous and making an impact. But if it's all done with ignorance grasping into existence and no renunciation of samsara, no bodhicitta, no wisdom, then it really is an exercise in futility. No matter how many other people say, wow, what you've done is so magnificent, it's so fantastic, you're really da-da-da-da-da, and everybody writes about you in the newspapers and praises you. You know, in 100 years, nobody's going to know your name. Nobody's going to know what you did. You say, well, they will, you know, I'll be listed in the history book. Look at Thomas Edison, you know. He flew a kite and now he's famous. You know, but how long is this planet going to exist? And, you know, so what? Your name is in a history book. So what? You know, really, does that benefit you in any way? Okay, so, you know, taking rebirth due to confusion is a futile, you know, engagement. We should really try to get out of the cycle of existence and help others to do likewise. So the verse, how Aryadeva responds to Job Lowe's question, he says, when dependent arising is seen, confusion will not occur. Thus, every effort has been made here to explain precisely this subject. Okay, so when we understand dependent arising completely, fully, in all of its different forms, in all of its different levels, yeah, then confusion won't occur, meaning that ignorance will be abolished. Okay. Thus, every effort has been made here in this text that he's teaching to explain precisely this subject. Or every effort has been made in the Dharma in general, in the Buddha's teachings, to really get us to understand the subject of dependent arising. Okay, so we're going to talk about dependent arising a little bit here. So you might remember when we've been studying with Jeffrey and the expression that dependent arising is the meaning of emptiness and emptiness is the meaning of dependent arising. So it's going to come up here. Okay. So if a sprout or karma, for example, existed from their own side, by their own nature, they wouldn't depend on a seed or ignorance. So if a sprout existed from its own side, it wouldn't depend on a seed because it would have its own nature, its own entity. It wouldn't depend on anything else to arise, to become what it is. Similarly, karma, our actions, if our actions existed from their own side, they too would be, you know, They wouldn't depend on ignorance because actions would, again, have their own nature. They wouldn't depend on causes. Okay, you getting what I'm saying? Because remember, in the 12 links of dependent arising, karmic formations, or karma, the second link depends on the first link of ignorance. So if all these links existed from their own side, they wouldn't depend on the previous link. They wouldn't depend on causes. They would just be there, independent of other factors. Okay. However, we can see that a sprout depends on a seed, and our actions, our polluted actions, depend on ignorance. Okay. So using many reasonings we understand that things are only dependent arising. They don't exist from their own side. Okay. So by using reasoning, and also by opening our eyes and looking at what's around us, we see that, you know, at least for causal dependence, if we open our eyes, we can see that everything that functions, that changes, depends on causes. Okay? To understand the subtler levels of dependent arising, depending on parts, mutual dependence, dependent on imputation, there we require some more reasoning and explanation. Okay? But, when we begin to see that, then we see that things that are dependent arising cannot exist from their own side. Okay? Because existence from its own side means that something is out there, objective. Okay? It doesn't depend on any other factors like causes. Doesn't depend on factors like its own parts, or its attributes, or its qualities, and it exists totally independent of the mind. So, you know, this is a cup without anybody labeling it cup. This is a telephone without anybody having the conception of telephone and giving it the label. Yeah. And so while things appear to us to be like that, you know, when we stop for a minute and ask ourselves, is this a cup without anybody giving it the label cup? Yeah. If nobody gave this thing the label cup, would you know it's a cup? Would it be a cup? No, you know. If we didn't have the idea, oh, all of this is one object and it functions to hold liquid that we drink, if we didn't have that idea and this basis here, you know, there wouldn't be a cup. So, you know, things that everything exists dependent on having a basis and then the mind conceiving and labeling it doesn't exist independent of different, of all these other factors, okay? So, you know, even when we say I, our innate feeling of I is there's just this independent entity there. Yeah, when you say I, and you think I, don't you get the feeling of like just this independent thing that's there, that's me. I, me. You know. But then, would I exist without, you know, a mind conceiving of a person and giving it the label I? Yeah? It wouldn't, would it? Yeah? Somebody has to say, oh, there's a body and mind there. That must be a person. And then, in particular, our mind, on the basis of the collection of body and mind, gives that name, I. Somebody else says, other, jerk, you know. Gorgeous one, whatever they label, okay? But I is, yeah. Okay? So when dependent arising, free from existing by its own nature, is seen directly with a reliable cognizer, a valid cognizer, then ignorance, confusion won't arise. When confusion ceases, then the next branch, independent arising, karmic formation ceases. Then suffering ceases. Okay? So all the afflictions and all the suffering that results from the afflictions and all the karma, you know, all of this cease when the confusion ceases, and what ceases confusion is seeing dependent arising, because dependent arising is the exact opposite mode of existence from the mode of existence that ignorance apprehends. So ignorance apprehends, grasps onto true in existence, existence from its own side, objective existence, all these things. And dependent arising is the total opposite of those things. Okay. Now it sounds very easy to say that, but to really understand it is not so easy. Yeah. Because even within the Buddhist schools, the lowest schools say, yes, things are dependent arising, and they also exist objectively from their own side. Yeah? So understanding that if something is, that dependent arising is the opposite of what ignorance apprehends, is not so easy. Because these lower schools, they're not a bunch of fools. You know, they have reasons and, you know, to think what they think. Okay? But from the Prasangika Vanyamaka viewpoint, yeah, when you really investigate with reasoning thoroughly, then you see that inherent existence or, you know, and dependent arising are totally incompatible. You know, that if something is inherently existent, it can't arise dependently. And if something dependently arises, it can't exist from its own side inherently. Okay? So, thus this test really makes an effort to explain how that's so, and especially in the last 8 chapters of the text. We're only on chapter 6. When we get to chapter 9, then it gets into that topic. Okay? So, J. Tsongkhapa's text, The Ocean of Reasoning, which is a commentary on Nagarjuna's treatise on the Middle Way, says, emptiness comes to mean dependent arising for who have refuted inherent existence through a reliable cognizer, not for others. Okay, so remember when we were studying with Jeffrey, he kept on saying, emptiness comes to mean dependent arising. Yeah, for madhyamikas, okay, so people who have the highest view, yeah, who have refuted inherent existence through reliable cognizer. Okay, so it's somebody who has at least an inferential realization of emptiness. So emptiness coming to mean dependent arising does not happen until, you know, for somebody who lacks at least a reliable cognizer that inferentially realizes emptiness. Okay? So it's interesting, yeah? Okay, well, we'll get to that. Yeah. So when Madhyamikas explicitly ascertain that external and internal things arise dependently, reliant on causes, then they ascertain the meaning of the emptiness of inherent existence through the force of that very awareness. Okay, so when such Madhyamikas, so people who have already a valid inferential realization of emptiness, okay, when they ascertain that external and internal things, okay, so external objects, internal states of mind, yeah, when all these things arise dependent on causes. Okay, when they realize that, Then they ascertain the meaning of the emptiness of inherent existence through the force of that very awareness. Okay? So they've already realized emptiness. Otherwise, just knowing that things are dependently arising doesn't mean that you will automatically know that things are empty. So it says, you know, when Majjhimikas explicitly ascertain that external and internal things arise dependently on causes, okay, they ascertain the meaning of the emptiness of inherent existence. Now, it has to be these kinds of Majjhimikas, yeah, because, you know, otherwise, somebody just knowing that things are dependently arising, that doesn't mean that they've understood emptiness. Okay? Because, you know, the lower schools realize that things are dependent arising, but they don't realize emptiness. Mm-hmm. A farmer knows that the crop depends on seeds, but a farmer hasn't necessarily realized emptiness. You know, the kitty knows that getting fed in the morning depends on waking me up, but she doesn't know that, you know, her meal is dependent, is empty of true existence. Okay, so just ascertaining dependent arising doesn't necessarily give you that ascertainment of emptiness. Okay? Yeah, so that's why it says, why such Majjhimikas. Mm-hmm. So people have already realized emptiness. Now, what does it take to have that inferential realization of emptiness? You need the syllogism, you know. We'll just say the person, for example, is empty of inherent existence, or is empty of existing from their own side, because they're a dependent arising. So just because, or we'll take the sprout is empty of true existence because it's a dependent arising. Just knowing that the sprout is a dependent arising doesn't mean you've realized its emptiness. Because remember in the syllogism, there's the different modes of existence, or the different modes, the different criteria for a valid syllogism. So one is that the reason has to apply to the subject of the syllogism. So that we know, the sprout is a dependent arising. But then you have to know the privation, that if it's a dependent arising, it must be empty of true existence. So many people may know that a sprout is a dependent arising, but they don't know that if something is a dependent arising, it's empty of true existence. Okay, so they don't know the privation. And I'm not talking about, you know, for this Majjhimika, such Majjhimikas who have this realization. It's not just intellectual. Oh yes, of course, it's dependent arising, it's empty. It's like they really get it, you know? And it has this inferential realization has a very strong impact on the mind. Okay? So, so are you getting it? That, you need to see both of those criteria of the syllogism, not just that the sprout's empty of true existence, but that if it's, not just that the sprout is dependent arising, but that if it's a dependent arising, it's empty. Okay? And so the only one who's going to have understood that completely is somebody who already has that realization. Okay. Then, through explicitly ascertaining that phenomena arise dependently, those who have the correct view of reality, in other words, those people who realized emptiness with this inferential, reliable cognizer. Okay. So, through explicitly ascertaining that phenomena arise dependently, those who have the correct view of reality will immediately and explicitly ascertain their emptiness of true existence. Okay? Because, okay, so that means that here you have somebody with the correct view, and they're looking at the cup, or they're looking at a person, and they go, and they're thinking about, wow, that person is totally dependent on their parts and being given the label person by a mind, you know, that there's no person there from the own side, because all that exists is something that's a dependent arising. Okay? So that person who's looking, you know, at a person, themselves or somebody else, and thinking like that, yeah, then immediately and explicitly they will know that the person is empty of true existence. Okay? You following me? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay? So, because by understanding that true existence implies independent existence, they know validly that independent existence and dependent arising are contradictory. Okay? So, that person knows, yeah, that true existence, inherent existence, all these things mean that something is independent. It doesn't exist through depending on causes and conditions, on parts, in relationship to anything else, doesn't exist dependent on, a mind and a label, nothing like that, okay? So they know that true existence implies that independent existence. And they know that independent existence and dependent arising are totally contradictory. Yeah? Because dependent existence and independent existence, something is either one or it's the other. It can't be both. And there's nothing that is neither. Okay? So, yeah? If they see something that's dependent arising, they immediately and explicitly ascertain that thing's emptiness of true existence. Because they know that if that thing were true existent, it would inherently exist, and that's contradictory to the dependent arising that they've just realized, that they're just, you know, tapping into. Okay? So that is seeing that emptiness is the meaning of dependent arising. Okay? So there's three types of dependent arising. And these three types are taught in a couple of different ways. The usual way that is coming from Jhankha is there's causal dependence, then dependence on parts, and then dependent designation. Okay? So causal dependence applies only to things that are products, okay, that are composite phenomena. Depending on parts and depending on name and imputation, they pertain to both causal things, products, and also unproduced phenomena like space or like emptiness or true cessation or something like that. Okay, so causal dependence is easier to understand than dependence on parts. And both causal dependence and dependence on parts are easier to understand than dependence on name and concept or dependence on imputation. So there's kind of levels of dependent arising there. Okay, and, you know, and we can see, I mean, dependence on causes, I mean, we kind of grow up thinking about that, you know. If you want to do good, you know, if you want to get a good job, you got to get a good education. If you want to have pancakes, you need to make the batter and cook it. Okay, we know that kind of stuff. And then, you know, things depend on parts. That, we kind, you know, when we think about it, we may know. And I think especially through when we study science, then we think, oh yeah, things are a compilation of atoms and molecules. You know, the body is a compilation of cells. Yeah. So we begin to have that idea. But then things being dependent on conception and term, you know, on a basis of designation and a designating mind and a designating term, we don't always think of that one. Okay? Yeah? Because somehow maybe on a basic level we realize that, okay, somebody doesn't become a president until everybody agrees to give them that name. Yeah, I mean, when we think about it that way, oh yeah, we all understand that, you know. And that you don't become Jigme until somebody gives you the name Jigme. Yeah. So people understand that. But there's something deeper than just that, okay? So understanding causal dependence is a means to then understand dependent parts, and then both of those are means to understand dependent designation. Okay? Now, another way, the way His Holiness often explains dependent arising, is he says, he first breaks it into two, causal dependence and dependent designation. And then within dependent designation, he again breaks it into two. One being mutual dependence, and the other being mere dependence, a dependent designation, okay? Or dependence on term and concept. So mutual dependence means that, like, you know, long depends on short, okay? Self and other depend on each other. This side of the valley and the other side of the valley depend on each other. Okay? And when you think deeply about it, anything having any identity depends on the other things that exist. You know, this cup can't be a cup, you know, unless it depends on things that occupy, that you put in the cup, and it depends on a person who's going to drink a cup. Because without a person that's going to drink from the cup and the beverage in the cup, you would not call this a cup. Okay? So the mutual dependence of saying, you know, like a beverage and a cup and a drink, or, you know, sometimes we say a drink, drinking and drinker, you know, all those things depend on each other. They can't exist independent. So that's mutual dependence. And then mere dependent designation, or dependent on term and concept, okay, that's the same as before, that, you know, the mind has to take, you know, different things, put them together, and on the basis of that, then conceptualize an object and give it a name. Okay? So, to fully understand dependence on designation by conceptuality, to fully understand it, one must understand emptiness. Okay? So, understanding, you know, causal dependence, understanding dependence on parts, you know, can be a reason to prove emptiness. Understanding dependence on term and conceptuality is a reason to understand, you know, is a reason to understand emptiness. But you don't fully understand dependence on designation by conceptuality until after you've realized emptiness. Okay? Which means, okay, that you have an understanding of emptiness, even the inferential one, and you're focused on the emptiness. When you come out of your meditation, you still have to establish how things exist. Yeah? If you can't establish how things exist, then your emptiness, your realization of emptiness is not complete. It isn't accurate, because you're falling to the nihilistic extreme. So when, after you realize emptiness, when you come out of the meditation, you have to be able to establish how things exist on a conventional level. And that is through dependent designation. And you don't completely understand how things arise due to mere dependent designation until after you've had some kind of realization of emptiness. Yeah? It's quite amazing. Okay, so through the force of explicitly understanding emptiness, this subtle level of the subtlest level of dependent arising is ascertained without the need for further reasons. So when you ascertain by the force of explicitly understanding emptiness through either direct or inferential realization, the subtlest level of dependent arising on term and concept, is ascertained without the need for further reasoning. So that's the meaning of dependent arising is the meaning of emptiness. Okay? Remember when Jeffrey was doing this? You know, somebody who explicitly realizes dependent arising, then without, they immediately and explicitly, yeah, ascertain emptiness. They don't need anything more. They immediately go to that because they've realized emptiness before. And then somebody who's understanding emptiness, yeah, then they will, very easily ascertain the subtlest level of dependent arising, dependence on term and concept, without the need for further reasonings. So that's when you really understand that dependent arising and emptiness come to the same point. That's when you really, really get it. Okay? So, you know, in Lama Tsongkhapa's three principal aspects of the path, that's what it's getting at. That's when your analysis of the profound is complete. Yeah, when you can actually get that. Okay? So dependent arising serves as both the reason to prove emptiness and the meaning of emptiness. Okay. So dependent arising is the reason for emptiness because we say the sprout is empty of inherent existence because of being a dependent arising. Okay. So dependent arising is the reason that establishes emptiness. But it's also the meaning of emptiness in that when you explicitly understand emptiness, then the subtle level of dependent arising is ascertained without any need of further reasons. So you understand that dependent arising is the meaning of emptiness. So by merely understanding the dependent arising of a sprout, okay, in other words, that the reason applies to the subject, the sprout is dependent arising, one does not understand its emptiness of true existence. Okay? If one did, it would not be the reason establishing the emptiness of true existence, because lots of people already understand that the sprout depends on causes and conditions. Okay? But they haven't realized that because it depends on causes and conditions, it's empty. Okay? So we must understand that if it's dependent arising, it must be emptied, you know? That you must understand both of those criteria for the syllogism. So when you understand that existing by its own nature is negated in many ways by many kinds of reasoning, okay, you understand how phenomena exist. In other words, you understand that they're empty. Yeah. And you also understand that they exist because they're dependent arising. So understanding that they only exist dependently means you should thereby understand they don't exist from their own side. Okay? Things only exist independently. So this is unique to the Prasangikas. Yeah?
It exists dependently.
Yeah, things only exist dependently.
Dependent.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Sorry. Good. Glad you're awake. Glad you caught. Okay? So, you know, and that's different than the lower schools, which say things exist dependently and they also exist objectively. And the lower schools say that because they say if things merely existed, independence on term and concept, then anything could be anything and nothing would exist at all. That to exist dependently, something has to have some kind of essence. If it doesn't, it doesn't exist at all, and you're nihilistic. So the lower schools, you know, to establish that they aren't nihilistic, say, well, yeah, something's a dependent arising, and it also exists from its own side. And it's only for the prasangikas can say, it's dependent arising, and it's empty of existing from its own side. Yeah. In other words, when you search with ultimate analysis, trying to find out exactly what this object is, you can't find anything that exists from its own side. Yeah? You don't find any existence from its own side. Okay, so Nagarjuna praised the Buddha in his expression of worship in the 60 stanzas of reasoning. That's one of Nagarjuna's famous texts. And His Holiness quotes this verse a lot. So Nagarjuna says, homage to the king of subduers who taught dependent arising, eliminating inherent, in parentheses, arising and disintegration in this way. So the Buddha's called the king of subduers because he subdued all the afflictions and both the afflictive obscurations and the cognitive obscurations. So this king of subduers who taught dependent arising, and here it means not just dependent on causes and conditions, it also means dependent on conceptuality, okay? And through doing that, eliminating, here the literal translation is eliminating arising and disintegration in this way. But you have to insert eliminating inherent arising and disintegration in this way, because Nagarjuna isn't saying there's no arising and disintegrating. Okay. So Chandrakirti then explains why, out of all the excellent qualities that the Buddha has, Nagarjuna would choose this one of explaining emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence as meaning dependent arising, as the thing to praise the Buddha for. Like, the Buddha has infinite compassion for all sentient beings. He's realized impermanence. He can manifest so many different bodies for what sentient beings need. But Nagarjuna doesn't praise the Buddha for those qualities. He praises the Buddha for explaining that the emptiness of inherent existence is the meaning of dependent arising. Okay? That's really something. When you think of all the excellent qualities the Buddha has, and then this is the one that Nagarjuna picks to praise, you know, that's saying that this teaching is incredibly important. Yeah? And that without this teaching and this realization, the Buddha wouldn't have any of the other qualities. He wouldn't be able to manifest all of those bodies. He wouldn't, you know, have the, you know, that infinite compassion that also sees the sentient beings as empty of true existence. Okay? He wouldn't have those, you know, that full Buddhahood depends on understanding that emptiness is the meaning of dependent arising, and dependent arising is the meaning of emptiness. Okay, so this is the principal doctrine of insight without which we can't attain either liberation or omniscience. So even hearers and solitary realizers have to understand this. So the Buddha has direct ultimate perception of emptiness as dependent arising, and therefore he can teach it from personal experience. Okay? And then to remember here that emptiness is a non-affirming negative. Okay, and a non-affirming negative is a negative which is such that the term expressing it does not suggest in place of the negation of its own object of negation, another positive phenomena. So when we negate inherent existence, when we say empty of inherent existence, no positive phenomena is being applied from that term. It's just the lack of true existence, the lack of independent existence. Okay? So we shouldn't think of emptiness, which is the ultimate nature or the ultimate truth, as some reified, concrete, absolute existence. You know? Because emptiness also is empty, and emptiness also exists dependently. So this is something also that's very, very important, because it's so easy to say emptiness is the ultimate nature, and then we make emptiness true existence. It's some kind of true existent nature that exists there independently of everything else, and that's the nature of everything else. Wrong. Okay? So, you know, the Prasangikas and Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti in particular keep chopping away at all our tendency to, you know, I want to hold on to something. Yeah? Can't I at least make emptiness some absolute existence? No. Okay. So then the next verse. Yeah, it's going to be a little bit easier.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So it sounds almost like, or I must be interpreting this wrong, that meditating on dependent arising or relying on, quote, dependent arising as the king of reasonings is not the route. You have to understand emptiness first, like you can't use this reasoning.
No. That's not what was said.
Yeah, I didn't think this was. That's what.
Yeah, yeah. You know that. Yeah, I mean, I remember once going to one of my teachers, you know, and asking that question. You know, well, you don't fully understand dependent arising till after you've realized emptiness. So how can dependent arising be a reason establishing emptiness?
Right.
Okay, because, you know, that dependent arising, the one that you start with, is causal dependence. Mm-hmm. Remember in Jay Rinpoche's things, when you see the cause, what is it, the verse? When you see the cause and condition of everything in samsara, nirvana? What's that verse? We have it memorized.
In the three principles?
Yeah, in the three principal aspects of the path.
So you see the novel effect of dependent arising.
Yeah, I get this. I have it memorized, and then when I have to recite it, I can't. Okay. One who sees the infallible cause and effect of all phenomena in cyclic existence and beyond, and destroys all false perceptions of their inherent existence, has entered the path which pleases the Buddha. So that's the dependent arising, the causal dependence, you know, he's saying there, has destroyed all false perceptions of inherent existence. So that's the one that you start out with. Yeah. And you can still use dependent on parts and dependent on, you know, on terms and concepts. But you don't fully understand dependent on terms and concepts until after you've realized emptiness, when you're coming out and you have to establish how things exist.
So you have to apply all those other different reasonings as well to get to that point.
Yeah.
And then come back to this.
Yeah, well, you apply many different reasonings if on the Bodhisattva path, because you need to develop skill in all those reasonings so that you can teach them to others. Okay, if you're on here a solitary realizer, you can depend on one reasoning.
And this one would do it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Okay, so then, the next verse, verse 137, is we're moving to into a next new section here, which is a detailed explanation of how to abandon anger and desire. Okay? And so first, we're going to talk about how to abandon desire. And within that, the characteristics of a person habituated to desire. Okay? So what's a person who has a lot of desire like? So, so Joe Blow says, how do you recognize people in whom desire is a strong habit? So Aryadeva says, they always like claiming the earth, in quotations, are extravagant, greedy, and fastidious. Characteristics such as these are seen in people with desire. Okay, so claiming the earth, you know, this thing that they like, is a theatrical role in ancient India, in which an actor who has charge of the stage demarcates the area by doing a dance. Okay? So the idea is that, like dances, this person likes fun, flirtation, flowers, perfume, jewelry, you know, beautiful music, gorgeous things to look at, nice food. They're a connoisseur of wine. They're a connoisseur of hamburgers. Mm-hmm. They can tell you which fast food joint, you know, has the tastiest hamburgers. They can't tell you which one kills you the most through poisoning you with their hamburgers. But they'll tell you which one tastes better, okay? So they're extravagant. You know, they love to spend money. They love extravagant events. You know, they love to go out and have a good time. They're very greedy. They're always looking out. How can I get something? How can I have something? This is mine. That's yours. They're always differentiating what's mine and what's yours and attached to what's mine. They're very clever. Yeah. They can talk you into anything. And they're quite alert. They're very good with words. Okay. So that's how you can tell somebody habituated to desire. And then he says the opposite characteristics are seen in people who are inclined to anger. Okay. They're dour. They're, you know, they're in a bad mood. They're always looking the negative side of things. You know, they're always complaining, this is wrong and that's wrong. You know, somebody invites them out to have a good, you know, for some fun or a good meal. Oh, I don't want to go. You know, it's just the food there stinks. You know, I don't like these people. I don't like the way things are done. Okay. And then those whose behavior is a mixture of the two are inclined towards confusion. Okay. Yeah. So remember last time we were saying we were going around and, you know, which are we, which of the three are we most inclined to? Well, here's some ways you can look at yourself and see, you know. Okay. And you can see it, you know, when you're meditating, what does your mind go to? I want to go here, I want to go there, I want to do this, I want to do that. This is so beautiful, this is so wonderful. If only I can have this, only I can have that. That was so much fun. I want to go do that again. This thing is so gorgeous. You know, if that is what is your principal distraction, then you're inclined towards desire. If your principal distraction is, oh God, I have to do this again. And yet 10 years ago my brother did that, and 15 years ago my sister did this, and then my parents, you know, on and on and on. Then the government is this, and I really don't like this, and these people do this, and they're always so terrible, and they blame me, and you know, how come people can't be different? On and on. So if that's your main distraction, you know you're inclined towards anger. Yeah? Okay. So that doesn't mean that if we're inclined towards anger, we never have, you know, attachment distractions in our meditation. Or if we're inclined towards distractions, we never have angry ones. It's just, you know, kind of which one is more prominent. Okay? So that's how you can tell. Any questions? You kind of know that? Okay. So then the next verse is about the means of caring for a person who's habituated to desire. So Job Low says, how do you train someone in whom desire is a strong habit? Okay. So you're a teacher. You've got to train these disciples. What in the world do you do with some disciple who always wants to go out and have fun, and they want to go do this and do that, and they want to have this and want to have that, and why can't we do this? I want to do this, and this is so much fun, this is good, and, you know, kind of, can we do this? And this doesn't break the precepts, does it? Let's go do that. Yeah? Didn't really mean that you can't have fun when you're already in. Yeah, we can do this, we can do that, let's go out. You know? Okay, so how do you train somebody like that? So Aryadeva says, Buddha told those with desire that food, clothes, and dwellings are all to be avoided and to remain close to their spiritual guides. Okay? So the Buddha told them to avoid objects that are beautiful and are of top quality, because these things stimulate desire. Okay? So, fine clothes, fine food, clothes, dwellings, okay, things like that. And you can tell, you know, okay, you say, okay, well, we ordained. So, you know, we've given up all these wonderful clothes that you can wear on the outside, you know, I mean, all this jewelry. I remember my first Dharma course, you know, this outrageously colored full skirt with cloth from India, embroidered peasant blouse, and earrings down to here. And I was wearing the anklets from India that, you know, the little bells that make them. And my long hair and, you know, and, you know. Look at my long hair. I finally grew it out. Yeah, isn't it gorgeous? And, you know, so you may think, okay, well, I ordained, I got rid of all of that stuff. But then, you know, you go up to your fellow monastic and it's like, wow, that cloth of your dunkha is such nice cloth. What store did you buy that cloth at? I really like that color. I really like that texture. Yeah? What kind of shoes do you have? Oh, those shoes are really nice. Where did you get them? We can have those kind of shoes, can't we? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, your jola, you know, your bag. I really like the embroidery on that. You know, it's maroon and it has this gold boundary. And look at the symbol embroidered on it. That's really cool. Yeah. Can you give it to me? Hint, hint, hint. You know? Yeah. Oh, your glasses. I really like the shape of your glasses. That's the latest style of glass frames. Yeah? Right? You know, so we still find all sorts of things. Yeah. The lamp in your room is so nice. You know, how come the storekeeper gave you that lamp? I just have to use the overhead light. You got a tensor lamp. Look at your bedspread. Yeah, you got a nice bedspread. You got a bedspread. I just have a blanket. Yeah, we still get attached to things, don't we? I don't don't like this room. I want the room in the corner with the two windows on each side. I don't like this room. And I don't want a roommate. You know. This is a single room. I don't care how many beds you can fit in it. So, you know, so Buddha told them to avoid things like this. So there's a lot more in this verse, but we're out of time, so I'll continue with this verse next time. In the meantime, yeah, look at the color of her chugu. I really like it. Mine is like this color.
Do you
have a change? No, this is mine, and I've had it since I was ordained, and I'm going to die in this chugu. You can't have it. But I really like the color. But I can only have one. Yeah, we can only have one. The three robes, we can only have one. So which one am I going to have? This one. Okay.
Yeah, it's really inspiring to, in this case, to read the biographies of these masters who had really nothing and have been realized because they let go of all these greediness and picture.
Yeah. Because we always feel, oh, I can't practice Dharma unless I have good food and a comfortable place to sleep and, you know, I'm warm enough and I'm not too hot and, you know, I need enough protein. I can't practice Dharma if I don't have enough protein. But the other person saying, but I can't practice if I don't have enough chocolate. The other one said, I can't practice unless I have, you know, enough carbs. Yeah, somebody else said, I can't practice unless I have enough fat. So, I mean, yeah, so to really realize we don't need any of that to practice. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. And may the light of Losang's teachings dispel in the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Nangur Ratnamandar Kamniryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ashravasti Abbey in the West flourish.